Straight Talk on WRHI is presented by Founders Federal Credit Union. Relax, you're with Founders. Now here's Manning Kimmel broadcasting live from Substation 2 on Cherry Road in Rock Hill with Straight Talk, selected by the South Carolina Broadcasters Association as the state's top public affairs program.
And a good afternoon. Welcome into Substation 2, Cherry Road across from Winthrop, for another edition of our Straight Talk program, presented by Founders Federal Credit Union. Relax, you're with Founders. Our thanks to our co-sponsor today, Anderson Griggs Investments at Old Town Rock Hill. Common sense, intelligent advice for conservative investors. You can find out more online at AndersonGriggs.com. And our thanks to Piedmont Medical Center, a community built on care, PiedmontMedicalCenter.com. With us, the very elusive State Senator Wes Clymer. How are you doing,
Senator? Man, I'm great. Good to be with you again.
Where you been, pal?
Been down in Columbia all the time.
And you don't look like you are any worse for the wear.
Well, I'll look forward to 2 weeks from now when I can reintroduce myself to my children and wife and spend some time back at the house again.
Oh, my. So how would you stack up this session of the General Assembly? Productive? About the same?
Well, you have to kind of grade it on a curve, right?
So big bell curve.
By private sector standards, by the way the world ought to operate standards, another disappointing, exercise in futility on a lot of important things. But judging it by traditional Senate standards, the Senate has been substantially more productive than it has been in recent years, and that owes substantially to rules changes that were adopted on the first day of session that made it more difficult for a single senator to thwart the will of 45 other senators. There are 46 senators total. And so a lot more meaningful legislation has moved this year than is typical, but still, you get into the last week or two of session, which is where we are now, and start to become filled with remorse over all the things that you really hoped would happen that haven't made it across the finish line.
So explain for the listeners, when we talk about rules changes, you're referring to one of these rules where just one lowly senator can get up there and tie up a whole slew of legislation just because they didn't like it.
Yeah, so historically in the state Senate, in a 45 against one situation, the one would usually prevail. Because either by way of a filibuster, which can be broken by a three-fifths vote on third reading, but more importantly, a senator's ability to offer unlimited amendments, right? So you could have a bill that was up for debate, and a senator really is opposed to it. That senator offers 14,000 amendments, and then it takes the entire months of March, April, and May to wade through those amendments, and you effectively, you either kill the session or kill the bill. And so the rules were changed at the beginning of this year to significantly curtail senators' ability to engage in that kind of behavior. So now, a cloture motion, a motion to end a filibuster, can be made that includes limitations on the total number of amendments, the total number of amendments per senator, and even a time certain to vote. And so that has had a very real deterrent effect on the type of dilatory behavior that has been all too commonplace in the past, and that's allowed the Senate to work through a lot more meaningful legislation than it normally would.
You also got through, I'll call it the Clymer Amendment or the Climate Rule, about earmarks.
Secret earmarks are gone in the Senate, and that's something I worked on for, goodness, 5 years and really dug in hard over the last three to really make it an issue. And as part of that rules package on the first day of session, the Senate adopted rules allowing a senator to raise a point of order against anything that looked like a secret earmark. And now this year, the Senate had budget debate last week. On the first day of budget debate, every senator was given a list of all the earmarks in the budget, where they're going, who requested them, what the project is. It's the kind of transparency that should have been there all along, and it was just incredibly encouraging to see progress on that front. I mean, that's what taxpayers deserve, right? In the past, before this rules change was adopted, of the 46 senators, zero knew what was in the budget. because, you know, the chairman of the Finance Committee in the Senate would have promised certain, you know, projects to certain senators, and over in the House, the chairman of Ways and Means would have done the same, and neither of those two knew what the other had promised in secret to, you know, the members of the other chamber, and so you had zero lawmakers knowing what was in the budget. This year, we know it was in the budget. So it's been a long time coming. It's a great improvement to the way the state spends money and a real benefit to taxpayers.
By your best inclination, how many of those earmarks, let's say you had 50 earmarks,
yeah,
how many of those would probably will not get through or did not get through as a result of them being exposed?
Well, so the transparency has value for a couple reasons, right? The most important being the transparency dimension.
Sure.
But the other one is the fact that senators know that anything they ask for is going to be on public display. It chastens the impulse to ask for things that may come back to haunt them or be embarrassing. And so the list of projects funded in this budget are, you know, significantly better than what you would find in the secret earmarks in years past. You know? And no, in fairness, I still think some of the earmarks that were requested are dubious in value and really struggle to meet the definition of core function of state government, right? But in the main, they were significantly improved, and you didn't see as many earmarks go into things like fake charities, which has been a real problem in the past. Oh, and then another proviso I got added to the budget changes the threshold by which the state auditor can be requested to audit an entity that receives funding from the state. And so that creates yet another deterrent to the kind of malfeasance we've seen in the past with legislators sending money in directions that are probably, you know, legally problematic.
So, and I don't want to get too tied up with this, but when somebody identifies something that is an earmark,
yeah,
is clearly identified so the senators know what they're voting for.
Right.
But you're not making that earmark stand alone as a separate piece of legislation.
Correct, right. Okay. It's just there's a, I think it was Proviso 118 included just a list of all of the member specific project requests.
All right, so the budget. The budget has gone from your austere.
So it came over from the House to the Senate, and now going back to the House.
Okay. Overall, when the budget that we, let's see, the current fiscal year is basically a mirror of the fiscal year before that, correct?
Right.
So this fiscal year, the proposed fiscal year, is what? How much bigger than what we've been running on for 2 years?
So the state had $390 plus or minus million dollars in new recurring money.
Okay.
That's money that can be used to fund expenses that you expect to have year after year after year, and then about $1.7 billion in non-recurring money, which is money that you don't, budget estimators are skeptical will come back year after year after year.
So technically there's $2 billion worth of money,
yeah,
most of which is one-time money.
Yeah.
And the other part is something we ought to get every year.
Right.
So
with the recurring dollars, you know, one of the biggest public policy challenges the state has had over recent years and continues to have is a teacher shortage, right? And so with that recurring money, the General Assembly or the Senate and the House to raise the starting pay for teachers, fully funded the annual step-up increase, and raised teacher pay by $1,000 per teacher, you know, regardless of your tenure. And it's important to note that's fully funded at the state level, so that doesn't come out of the, you know, local funds that districts would have to typically pay for compensation.
So with all that being said, a teacher could expect, if this bill passes,
first year teacher right out of college, $36,000 a year.
Okay.
Now that's the state minimum.
Right.
But you know, in Rock Hill and Fort Mill, and you know, a lot of other districts, they have higher teacher compensation packages than the minimum.
So I'm going to ask you the question that I ask every time this comes up.
Yeah.
We have we have a tremendous shortage of labor right now.
Yes.
Across the state.
Yeah. It's a real problem. It's a national problem.
It's a national problem. No question about it. National problem. But you all in Columbia have been very successful in attracting some of the best businesses any state could want.
Yeah.
You got Boeing. Let's talk about Boeing. You got Volvo. You got Michelin. You got all of these companies.
Sure.
They're all telling you, we are here because we need a good, well-trained labor force.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, why is it that this whole issue of teacher salaries is not addressed from the standpoint that if we're going to get the best teachers in the country to come to South Carolina, we're going to have to break through this model of $36,000 for a starting job.
Yeah.
It needs to be, whatever, $50,000. And to do that, it's going to take a whole bunch of money, and we're going to make that happen over the next 2 or 3 years and just break this mold and just get on with it.
Well, so the to your point, the salary increases that happened in this budget are part of a multi-year effort. I mean, a couple of years ago, South Carolina teachers were paid less than the Southeastern average. Now they're paid more than the Southeastern average, and I suspect and hope, frankly, that when the General Assembly reconvenes next year, that pay scale will continue to improve. Because, I mean, I believe that if you want smart, hardworking people to go into the field, you have to have compensation commensurate with their talents and abilities and education, and we're not there yet. I mean, frankly, you want that to be a good middle-class job that can support a mortgage, a car payment, and sending their kids to college, and there's still work to be done on that score. So I don't think that's the end. I think this is, a meaningful increase in an ongoing process.
Okay. To me, it's just taking too long.
Yeah.
That's Bob's getting too.
I would say that about 1,000 different things in Columbia. But, yeah, I know. I agree.
Well, as you said, you want to have a good middle-class type job where somebody can afford to have a house and a mortgage and all that kind of stuff. Which, as we sit here and speak,
I mean, we can also make this, law enforcement, firefighters,
absolutely,
right. I mean, there's a lot of work to be done on those scores.
So we are in an era where the term affordable housing is meaning more than it ever has before.
Mm-hmm.
All the categories you just talked about, it's very difficult for them to find affordable housing, particularly here in York County.
Mm-hmm.
We know what's happening here. So I often wonder, you can't control the price of raw materials. You can't control the price of labor. And so with a lot of these extra dollars that we have, has anybody thought about, why don't we take, I'm just grabbing a number here, why don't we take $50 million and we're going to put that into a pool to create affordable housing. And here's what we're going to do. We're going to buy bricks. We're going to buy block. We're going to buy 2x4s, we're going to buy OSB, we're going to buy plywood. We're going to have money for that stuff to help get the cost of building a house down for those categories that need to have a roof over their head.
So I think the most important thing you could do on affordable housing is to reduce the cost of government to housing stock. Right? And I've spent some time digging into this. It's a subject of real interest and concern for me because there are parts of York County where a nurse, a police officer, a firefighter, a teacher cannot buy a house, right?
Yeah.
And if our community continues, the inflationary pace it's on with housing stock, that's going to be true for most of York County in very short order, and that is a really, I think, unfortunate set of circumstances. It's an avoidable set of circumstances, and if you look at the cost of government as a portion of the cost of a house, you would find that local government is a leading driver of price inflation in housing. How?
Yeah, explain.
Yeah, so I don't subscribe to this. Some would say it's all about zoning. I don't think it's all about zoning. I think it's the Byzantine complexity of the planning and approval process. It is the delays caused by local government. It is the minute degree to which local government micromanages housing projects, right? And so, you know, there are some parts of the county that have really just exploded in growth, and you really needed a heavy government hand to mitigate some of the downsides of explosive growth, right? Thinking about Lake Wylie, Fort Mill, Tekakee, those areas that just boomed overnight. I mean, they really needed some help slowing things down. There are other parts of the county that...
No, impact fee didn't slow them down at all.
Didn't slow them down at all, no. Right. Yeah. The impact fee doesn't change the quantity of demand. It changes the quality of demand. And basically what that means is just you're going to have, you know, more expensive houses.
Yeah.
Right? So,
yeah.
You know, I mean, that's all it means. It doesn't change demand. It changes the kind of demand. But, you know, when you think about sort of workforce housing as the term, you know, if the sum of all of your municipal requirements accounts for $15,000 to $20,000 of the cost of a house, right? So, like in Charleston, historical preservation type stuff is really expensive, right? You got to have a certain type of window, a certain type of door, a certain type of brick. They're pricing people out of the city, right? If you have to have, you know, minimum lot sizes and minimum house sizes, a minimum number of this, a minimum number of that, and a minimum quality of air conditioner, and all of these things add up to where the, you know, cost of the bureaucracy, cost of government gets into 20-30% of the cost of a house, especially on the lower end of the housing spectrum, that sort of workforce housing where really a lot of people live.
Well, we could have this debate for 2 hours.
Yeah, right.
I still say, if you own a lot, if you have a lot, and you want to go out and build a house,
yeah,
with the prices of raw materials where they are today, you know, they're three or four times what they were just a year and a half, 2 years ago. With all that going on, and the, you know, this whole labor demand situation, that price of the house is just going to be way out of everybody's reach. You take a look at Habitat for Humanity.
Yeah.
They have a wonderful program that works very well.
Yeah, they really do. Yeah.
And it builds responsibility. People have to pay a mortgage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So if you took that, let's just say you took that $50 million I was talking about, let's just dump it into Habitat for Humanity. Let them build more houses the way they build houses, with volunteer labor. I mean, I just think I think there's a role for government in really trying to address this affordable housing issue. And I'm only talking about York County, South Carolina, where I want everybody to have an opportunity to have a roof over their head. That's all. End of discussion.
Well, we'll move on. Okay, I'll move on. All right.
I'll give you 30 seconds to rebut. Go ahead.
Well, no, I mean, I still, that may be all well and good, but until you really solve the problem, like, what is driving the long run? We have a shortage of commodities right now. We had shipping problems. We had COVID-related shutdowns. This stuff is temporary, ephemeral. The core structural issues driving the market really have to get addressed, and that includes addressing the cost of government and housing.
Can't even get chlorine for your swimming pool now.
Right? I know, right? Yeah.
We're going to take our mid-program break. Remind you that you are listening to Straight Talk, live from Substation 2, Cherry Road across from Winthrop, presented by Founders Federal Credit Union. Relax, you're with Founders. Our thanks to our co-sponsor today, Anderson Griggs Investments in Old Town Rock Hill. Common sense, intelligent advice for conservative investors. Find out more online at AndersonGriggs.com. And our thanks to Good Pharmacy, your hometown pharmacy, Ebenezer Road to Camden Avenue in Rock Hill. Now, of course, we prepare fresh subs and salads 7 days a week here at Substation 2. There is a magical way we do it. For those who may have forgotten, just pay attention to the cue card. At the count of three, we're all going to say it together. Are you ready? One, two, three. Hold on. Three.
Slice, slice, slice. Slice. Garden, 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 garden.
Back after these words.
If it's 12:30, it's Straight Talk on WRHI.
Save on your monthly mortgage payment with a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage from Founders Federal Credit Union. Take advantage of low rates while they're still around, and you'll also have no private mortgage insurance costs. The application process is easy, and your mortgage is serviced completely by Founders and always stays with us. Relax, you're home. For more, visit foundersfcu.com/30. Membership qualification required. Credit evaluation, underwriting requirements, terms and conditions apply. Institutions, NMLS identifier number 41064. 646.
Water, fire, mold, and storms cause property damage every day. When it happens to you, it's no time for second best. That's why insurance professionals trust the locally owned and family-run Paul Davis Restoration of Rock Hill. This is Gina Rogers. Paul Davis is committed to providing extraordinary care while serving our neighbors in their time of need. Our team is highly qualified and trained to handle each situation with care and professionalism. When disaster strikes, call Paul Davis. We are here to help. 329-1140 or pauldavisrockhill.com.
Wow, have things changed over the last year. This is Charlie Ruffalo. We're thankful for all your support through this situation, but we've come to a crossroad. Starting immediately, we will close on Sundays. This will allow us time to perform necessary maintenance and deep cleaning and also give us time to prepare for the week to come, but we're still willing to do caterings for special events on Sundays. We apologize for any inconvenience this may cause, but remember, we're still open Monday to Saturday. So come enjoy the best subs and salads in town. Substation 2, Cherry Road, across from Winthrop.
180 over 111, and I had a stroke. I couldn't speak or walk.
150 over 90, and I had a stroke.
This is what high blood pressure sounds like. You might not feel its symptoms, but the results from a stroke are far from silent. Get back on your treatment plan or talk with your doctor to create a plan that works for you. Go to loweryourhbp.org.
Head to toe, everything's changed.
Brought to you by the American Stroke Association, American Medical Association, and the Ad Council.
Straight Talk continues now on WRHI. Brought to you by Founders Federal Credit Union. Relax, you're with Founders.
And back we are here at Substation 2, Cherry Road across from Winthrop. And as you hear the sirens outside, that's a tornado warning. Pay attention to all the information that's on the radio and pay attention to what's on that electronic device in your pocket. And watch out what's going on. State Senator West. I knew I was going to do it. I knew
you got close.
I got
you caught yourself.
Almost.
30 years of habit, hard to break.
Wes Clymer is with us today. Oh, my goodness gracious. All right, enough of housing and what have you. Let's talk a little bit about some of these other items that you've been working on. One of the things that Randy Ligon, State Representative Randy Ligon, has talked a lot about is the open carry law. Where is that thing now?
So the House passed two open carry-related bills. One is, I'll call it, concealed weapons permit, CWP, open carry, right? So same licensing, all that stuff, just you can carry openly instead of having to conceal. And then the other is called constitutional carry, which is permitless open or concealed carry, right? So those bills went moved over from the House to the Senate a couple weeks ago, and on Thursday, the majority leader in the Senate, Senator Massey from Edgefield, used a sort of a fancy procedural motion and pulled from the Senate Judiciary Committee the it's H3094, I think, the CWP open carry bill, right? So that bill is now set for special order in the Senate where it'll be debated starting tomorrow.
Really? Yeah. Okay. So of the two versions, that's the one that you support?
Well, no, so the important thing to note about the bill that's on the floor is that constitutional carry can be added to it in the form of an amendment, right? So constitutional carry is a germane amendment, so there's going to be an up or down vote in the Senate. I'm going to vote for that amendment. I mean, I've long supported constitutional carry, and I don't know where ultimately the votes are on that. I think it'd be close in either direction, but I feel confident that one version or the other will ultimately pass. And to the point you raised a minute ago, you know, there's been a lot of, you know, gnashing of teeth on Twitter about how, I don't know, from the opponents of this. And it's just important to note that a lot of other states do things this way. A lot of other states have these protocols in place. And the parade of horribles simply has not come to fruition as a result of these policies. And so, anyway, I'll say that.
It's an interesting conversation. Just seems to me, I have no problems with the open carry. Doesn't bother me in the least. But, you know, I have a CWP, had it for years. I just don't understand why you wouldn't want, if you're going to give somebody that right to carry this thing, open carry, that they shouldn't have some kind of training to go with it, to make sure that we're not allowing some kind of wacko just to – I know he still has to have
a permit. So the counter-argument to that, I think, the government conditioning the exercise of a constitutional right is sort of inherently problematic, right? So there's one. And then two, the only people who follow gun laws are law-abiding citizens, right? So the people who aren't inclined to follow the law are already doing what you're talking about. They're just breaking the law to do it, right? So the universe of people we're talking about are those who are already inclined to obey the law.
Okay, move on. You have been working for quite a while. It's something that I'm sure will be near and dear to the hearts of those that are in the hospital business, and that is certificate of need. It's interesting that that this discussion is coming now.
Yeah.
After Piedmont Medical Center spent 15 years trying to get a certificate.
I think it's longer than that.
Could it be?
So God knows
how many millions of dollars.
So certificate of need is also, I call this the certificate of greed. But basically, any healthcare investment of any size, whether it's, you know, an MRI machine or a new hospital or, you know, frankly, an ambulatory care facility, any kind of meaningful healthcare investment, you have to go to the government and get permission first in South Carolina. Get a certificate of need. You have to demonstrate that there is a market need, and then the government gives you a permission slip to make that investment.
Now, the hospital administrators will tell you that they support that.
Yeah, the only people in this state that support the certificate of need are hospitals. Why? Because it allows them to box out competition, as happened in York County in the fight between Piedmont and Atrium for decades, right? It allows hospitals to box out competition, allows them to operate as oligopolies. It's sort of a cartel, and it unavoidably leads to higher prices for consumers, right? So I think one of the most important things that as a state, you know, so much of healthcare policy is decided at the federal level, but one of the most important things we can do as a state is to lift those barriers to investment, lift those barriers to competition, so that we get more investment in healthcare facilities and more people competing for our healthcare dollars, right? And so that bill, the full repeal of the certificate of need is legislation I've introduced several years, and I was able to get that onto the Senate floor last week during the budget debate. So leveraged a budget amendment into what ultimately became a unanimous consent request that got the full repeal bill out of medical affairs and onto the Senate floor.
So it will come up for a vote this week?
No, probably next year.
Oh, next year.
Yeah, because there's only 2 weeks of session left, and the CON debate is going to be a big one. But we have two-year sessions, so a two-year General Assembly. And that bill will be on the Senate calendar when the Senate reconvenes in January.
Well, it's an interesting concept. I mean, during this 15-plus year debate over Piedmont Medical Center versus CMC or Atrium for building this hospital, you know, one of the arguments was advanced, well, let the chips fall where they may. Let them both build a hospital.
Build a hospital.
Yeah, and see who will provide the best service.
That's right. But, and you know, let the consumer decide.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that ultimately this is about empowering consumers with more options and giving the ability to pick and choose, as opposed to having government block competition in courts.
So you would expect a rather robust debate next year when comes up.
Yeah. Now, we've got a lot of co-sponsors on the bill. There's a lot of grassroots support for the repeal. Medical societies or doctors groups from around the state are in favor of it. A lot of the doctors here in York County are in favor of it. Again, the only people who are against repealing the certificate of need are the hospitals, because they use it to pad their profit margins by blocking competition.
10 seconds. Santee Cooper. Is something going to happen this year or not?
Santee Cooper reform bill passed. The sale amendment failed. I voted to sell, but was in the minority. And the details are now getting worked out between the House and Senate.
Okay, we'll see what happens. State Senator Wes Clymer, thank you very much for being with us today. Always interesting to have you on here. And we'll do it again. All right, buddy.
Thank you.
That'll wrap up our Straight Talk program live from Substation 2, Cherry Road across from Winthrop, presented by Founders Federal Credit Union. Relax, you're with Founders. Our thanks to our co-sponsor today, Anderson Griggs Investments in Old Town Rock Hill. Common sense, intelligent advice for conservative investors. Find out more online at AndersonGriggs.com. All right, now we got the whole Oliver gang here. So we're really going to knock this out of the park today. Fresh subs and salads prepared right before your eyes 7 days a week. Don't get up. Come on. All right, at the count of three, how do we do it? One, two, three.
Slice, slice, slice. Garden, garden, garden.
That's not bad. Back. We'll see you on Monday. Tomorrow. Bye.